Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The gentle rains of spring have begun to fall upon the dry and parched earth, and yes, indeed, by golly, we've got the morans a-sprouting. Oh, we do indeed. They're sprouting all over the place. Little shoots of stupid just coming up right through the earth.
Okay, you better believe it. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. Jeremy in Vermont noting loud and clear on TuneIn, Bob. Thank you. Good evening to the chat room. You can wander into the chat room if you'd like. Just pop on by headonradionetwork.com. Dwayne's in there, who recently celebrated a birthday. Gerald is there. Good evening, Gerald. Good evening, Jeremy in Vermont. Man Cave, who has a birthday today, is in there. Happy birthday, Man Cave. Oh, hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. No, I'm Bob Kincaid, not Cave. Might be time for a trip to the neurologist. I'm Bob Kincaid. Happy birthday, man, Cave. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you can be part of the headonradionetwork.com chat room if you wish. Oh my God, Jeremy, I'm so sorry. Shut it, Bob. It's snowing here as you speak. Oh, yuckity. Oh, poor Vermont. When will it stop snowing in Vermont? What is it? Well, that's what Boss Man Wayne always told me. Two seasons in Vermont. Dead of winter and 8 weeks of bad sledding. See, that's what I thought. That was a screw-up over at Skype alerting me to the birthday of Man Cave. I thought so. But better safe than sorry, right? Yeah. Well, yes, indeed. You can run on by, pick yourself out a password and a screen name, jump into the headonradionetwork.com chat room community, or don't. You know, either way's fine. Participate however you choose. Call or don't call. You know, we always welcome first-time callers. Insofar as it's a running article of faith here that we've never had anybody actually die during a phone call. Come close a couple of times, but nobody's ever actually died during a horn phone call. And we make it easy to participate in conversation radio, which, by the way, is, of course, a listener-supported operation. There are no ads here for Chevrolets, no ads here for Mercedes-Benz or Toyota, no ads here for Maybach, Rolls-Royce, Audi, Mercedes-Benz, no. No ads here for vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls, herbal remedies that will grow hair on said bowling ball. None of that. No buy gold now. The only thing that keeps the horn going, and this is very simple, and yet at the same time very complex, the only thing that keeps the horn going is you. And with that in mind, I want to extend thanks because we closed the weekend. $100 short. And we made up the vast majority of that shortfall in the 2 days of this here Easter weekend. And so with that in mind, I want to send thanks out to Grant and to Harold and to Michael for catching us up on that. Make sure I don't miss any names. One second. Oh, and to Chris. Thank you, Chris. Let's see. I think. And just checking. And James. Thank you, James. So those are all the people who caught us up over the weekend. And thanks now, very special thanks now, to Gary Laborman, who provided a Have a Show on Me Moran Monday, taking care of fundraising for the evening. Gary Laborman has a note that says, it would be nice to see some other of you loyal Kincaidians sponsor a day. We all know that any contribution helps, so do what you can as often as possible. Signed, Gary, a.k.a. Laborman. So it's not a challenge as such, but more in the way of a, what would we call that? An exhortation. There we go, an exhortation. So, yeah, that took care of Moran Monday. We could get out a day or so if some other folks would like to meet, exceed, challenge, whatever, what Gary has done. And, because there's a bill paying frenzy going on. There's always a bill paying frenzy going on around here. Because, again, nobody, you know, this is not anyone's particular attempt to get rich. It's just an attempt to keep even with all the things that come with doing this. And there are bills that are due right now. Thank you very kindly, everyone, as named. And thank you, Gary, for the Have a Moran Monday on Me. This Moran Monday brought to you by Laborman. Now, it is, of course, no kidding, Moran Monday. And, well, where to begin? I've got several potentials here. But let's back up perhaps by a couple of days and consider, oh, well, that's true. Gerald noting, no, Bob, if you wanted to get rich, you'd get a pizza joint and then refuse to cater gay weddings with pizza. And that's, you know, that still just stymies me. When's the last time you went to a wedding, gay or straight? When's the last time you went to a wedding where the reception was carry out pizza? Of course, after the memories pizza, I remember when my gut wasn't burning. It was just before the pizza. After the memories pizza folks reached $800,000, otherwise known as 800,000 dollars. Well, the thing just sort of shut down. Yeah. Well, hey, look, we can try, Gerald. This is, after all, a radio network that refuses to allow right-wingers to have a say in anything, not even so much as a good evening, good afternoon, good morning, goodbye, kiss my butt, none of that. You think we could build a humongous crowdfunding campaign around that? Probably not. Oh, well, at least we tried. Yeah. Oh, and of course, no, we won't be selling any poison Bella Wood crap either. Thank you for the reminder, Jeremy. Oh, and everybody reminding me this evening of the people who do not advertise on the horn, Ron in Canada. Don't forget Grumman. No, Northrop Grumman doesn't advertise here. Neither does that woman in the black polyester Dacron pantsuit who talks about how the energy, the future of energy is red, white, and blue American. I wonder if that woman will ever get work as an actress now that she's the face of poisoning America. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Ron. Ron says, I will make a $75 matching pledge. So we have a chance to get out into Tuesday if folks will put 75 bucks together to match what Ron has on the table. So that's not too hard at all. 3 at 25 and 25 at 3 and a whole bunch of other multiply. Let's see, that's 5, 6, 7, 15 at 5? Yeah. We could do that. The PayPal interface is over at headonradionetwork.com. Thank you very kindly, Ron. Thank you indeed. Pizza? Steve in New York City. No, sorry, labor man. With all respect due, if you opened up a pizza place to cater gay weddings, you'd really go out of business. No self-respecting LGBT or straight wedding would serve pizza. That was Gerald, not labor man, but no, the point is well taken, Steve. Especially from a place, I mean, even New York City pizza, which is without a doubt the most awesomest utility pizza on the planet, no doubt about it. But no, sorry. And I don't think wedding pizzas are going to replace wedding cakes anytime soon either. Mm-hmm. No, Marty, Papa John also does not advertise on the horn. So, with the understanding that, yes, it is Moran Monday on the horn, let's get the aching and creaking old Calliope fire.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hurry, 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 step right up, you will not believe your ears. It's Moran Monday on the horn. Here behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas, you will hear, much to your own consternation and amazement, right-wing Morans of every variety. We have birther Morans, deather Morans, ninther Morans, tenther Morans, booger-eating Morans, bagger Morans, bircher Morans, libertarian Morans, repig-licking Morans, Morans, one and all. Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this here's the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. We advise folks entering the Moran Monday tent to be particularly mindful of hanging on to purses, European messenger bags, small children, and the occasional service animal, as the right-wingers can get grabby. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. Indeed, indeed. So, where do we start? Well, I thought we would run out to the land of Lincoln, if you're okay with that. You know, Illinois. That's how you say Illinois. If you're all classy and stuff, Illinois. Recently, I got a note from Ben Birch over to WhiteRoseSociety.org noting that his congressional representative, Tammy Duckworth, has decided to challenge Mark Kirk of Illinois
yeah, for his Senate seat. Well, that apparently inspired Mark Kirk to get out there and claim his own space as a defender of freedom. Of course, we spell that FREEDUMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMMM with a real sense of panache, real je ne sais derp. Namely, without even actually knowing what is in the framework of the proposed future agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, never. Nobody's ever going to accuse Republicans of having all the facts before they unload all their freedom or their stupid into the universe. Mm-mm. It was back on Thursday that the framework was announced, and shortly thereafter, and you know, you don't just let this burble off of your tongue, or derple for that matter. You have to have this waiting in the wings, because bang, like a shot, Mark Kirk's office had the following out there for people's consideration. Mark Kirk ran to the first person he could find who would print a story, and that turned out to be Niels Lesniewski, or Niels Lesniewski, not sure which, it can go either way, tough call, but Niels works for Roll Call, and quoted Mark Kirk, senator from Illinois, as follows. Neville Chamberlain got a better deal from Adolf Hitler. Who had 6:17 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, huh? Come on. Just step forward. Step forward. Win your free ring of the cowbell on Moran Monday. Who had 6:17 p.m. for the first Hitler reference of the day, courtesy of Mark Kirk, Moran? Neville Chamberlain got a better deal from Adolf Hitler. No, really. That's what he said. Of course, because of the deal with Adolf Hitler, Neville Chamberlain, on behalf of the interested parties, well, everybody except the Czechoslovakians, Adolf Hitler annexed Czechoslovakia to the Nazi juggernaut. Interestingly, as a result of the announcement of this framework, and I dare say we could even propose that as a result of the agreement that hopefully will go into effect in June, if somehow or another the bloodthirsty, warmongering, war-hungry, anxious to send somebody else's kid to fight their godforsaken wars Republican Party doesn't scuttle the deal, I think it's safe to say that, no, Iran's not going to annex anybody. Nor did they say that they wanted to. Just to point this out. Yeah. I mean, this is right up there with Tom Cotton, who is also dumber than a bag of hammer handles. But apparently, not being dumber than a bag of hammer handles is one of those things that isn't really part of the job description for Republican and member of Congress. But, you know, there it is. God. I mean, I'm sorry. I usually like to hold off on our first Hitler reference until at least a half hour into the program, but there you go. Not my fault. for simply trying to prevent a... I had a note from Ramin Raleigh. Subject line, more Iran. Ron says, last week I asked why everyone seemed to be so afraid of Iran. It seems to be now that the world is ganging up on Iran to make that nation give up its sovereignty so that Israel can maintain its hegemony in the Middle East. Iran follows the rules. Israel thumbs its nose at us and the rest of the world. We're still giving them a pot of money each year. No one mentions that when we were trying to establish sanctions against the filthy apartheid regime in South Africa, Israel was trying to help them develop nuclear weapons. These are the folks we declare to be our greatest allies. With allies like this, we don't need enemies. And that's the truth. For your viewing, listening, or reading pleasure, and I don't think I've ever said these words together at the same time on this program, I commend to you Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, who, for some reason or another, was the recipient of an interview, in fact, with President Not Sure. And for those who are not sure, let me make clear that when we refer to President Barack Obama as President Not Sure, we are not, that is by no means an insult. In the film Idiocracy, President Not Sure is the smartest man in the world. And he is beset by a gaggle of idiots. So that's where President Not Sure comes from, in case anybody was wondering. Right. So Thomas Friedman had a sure enough, no kidding, really, why you'd do this, nobody knows. But, he gave Thomas Friedman an interview. And, well, Thomas Friedman is a longtime designee of More in Monday. And his, what's the phrase from Charlie Pierce? Lavish spaces for entertaining. But the cameras rolled, and Thomas Friedman asked pointed, incisive, piercing New York Times op-ed columnist questions of the president, right? And what was fascinating, well, first of all, it begins with one of those Friedman-esque stories that can never be verified as true or untrue. Thomas Friedman begins by noting that in September 1996, I visited Iran. One of my most enduring memories of that trip. Now, imagine this. You've flown all the way across the world into the forbidden world of Iran. And what do you do? I mean, do you gawk in awe at the mountains, the snow-capped peaks in the background of Tehran? Nope. Do you reflect in awe that you're standing in the very place where for thousands of years East and West have collided in cultural tumult? Nope. Not if you're Thomas Friedman. There's nothing, no reference in here as to whether or not his hotel lobby actually had lavish spaces for entertaining. But he says, in September 1996, I visited Iran. One of my most enduring memories of that trip was that in my hotel lobby, there was a sign above the door proclaiming, "Down with USA." Yeah? Because, of course, Thomas L. Friedman reads Farsi. He says, but it wasn't a banner or graffiti. It was tiled and plastered into the wall. The copy editor at the New York Times allowing Thomas Friedman to use italics for that sentence. Tiled. Wow, I thought to myself, that's tiled in there. That won't come out easily. Right. Really, Tom? That's well, you know, anything to provide the hook to the front end of an op-ed piece about your interview with President Not Sure. President Obama invited me to the Oval Office Saturday afternoon. One wonders if he offered, if President Obama offered Thomas Friedman some beans and some Kool-Aid in styrofoam cups like he did way back at the beginning of his administration when he invited all the liberals to come to the White House. You know, those liberal media types. You might recall he had had a sit-down, multi-course, white linen tablecloth. Of course it's white! With all the right silverware in all the right places and bone china and all that silly stuff. With right-wing opinion people, and then a week later, he had some liberals over to the White House for beans and Kool-Aid in styrofoam cups. Yeah, that's about how it worked out. President Obama invited me to the Oval Office Saturday afternoon to lay out exactly how he was trying to balance these risks and opportunities in the framework accord reached with Iran last week in Switzerland. I think it was at Stade, but I never know whether to pronounce the G or the S, and so we'll just say it was at Lausanne, which is not Lucerne. Okay, are we clear? Right. Well, the hoi polloi will never know anyway. So in this article, email coming in from Steve in New York, Friedman, that's Farsi for dumb. I'm willing to believe that. Maybe given the date and everything, maybe Friedman is Farsi for moron. But anyway, President Obama makes a credible case for, hey, look, we're this really huge country that spends a great gagging amount of money on our Pentagon defense budget. And Iran knows it could never win a war with us. And proceeds from there and talks about how engaging in Myanmar, engaging in Cuba, engaging Iran makes the world a better place and not a worse place. Which I'm sure had the Mark Kirks and whatnot of the world hopping up and down, flapping their little bat wings, and probably causing a real mess on the floor. Screaming things like, Neville Chamberlain! But what's fascinating about the interview is that, I've been thinking ever since I read it, how would one analogize this interview and what's in it and what's not said? Because it's a long thing, and it's worth, let me be clear, it is worth your time to read over at nytimes.com. And it's a big deal, and there's a lot of video embedded in it and the like. But it reminds me of that old saying that in music, the empty spaces between the notes are music too. The sounds not played are music as well as the sounds that are. And I came away from reading the entirety of this interview thinking, a lot of sounds not played in this. He tries very hard to placate people around the world who are just certain that poor little Israel is just going to be overrun with Persians. And to be fair, it's, you know, if you live there, I mean, you could not pay me to live in Israel. If I was Jewish, you could not pay me to live in Israel. Ugh. What a terrible place to live. But anyway, I mean, constantly beset on all sides, and never mind. it has a certain beauty, elegance, if you will, for the things that Barack Obama does not say. In regard to Israel, he said, "Now, what you might hear from Prime Minister Netanyahu, which I respect, is the notion, look, Israel is more vulnerable. We don't have the luxury of testing these propositions the way you do, and I completely understand that. And further, I completely understand Israel's belief that given the tragic history of the Jewish people, they can't be dependent solely on us for their own security. But what I would say to them is that not only am I absolutely committed to making sure that they maintain their qualitative military edge and that they can deter any potential future attacks, but what I'm willing to do is make the kinds of commitments that would give everybody in the neighborhood, including Iran, a clarity that if Israel were to be attacked by any state, that we would stand by them. And that, I think, should be sufficient to take advantage of this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see whether or not we can at least take the nuclear issue off the table." Well, okay. And what I mean about there being unplayed, you know, the silence is being music, too. This interview has a number of moments where there are implications that Barack Obama knows, and the whole world knows, and Israel knows that Israel cannot exist without the United States propping it up. Period. There's another quote where he says, and if anybody tries to mess with Israel, the United States will be right there. But more than anything else, as I sought as I sought for a working analogy, I thought about, say, a situation in which you have a family member who has a gun, and nobody else in the family has a gun. And the family member is holding the gun on the rest of the family, and the rest of the family says, "Now, nobody make him mad. Okay, nobody make him mad, because he might use it. I mean, we should probably stop talking so loudly. And nobody here should say that they want a gun, too, because that's not going to help the situation." Because the one thing you can read throughout this entire article, and I guess greater minds than mine, certainly greater minds than mine, have pondered the question of, how come nobody ever ixnay on the octay about the Israeli a ooksnay? This is all about Iran maybe someday, possibly, maybe someday getting a nuke. A nuke. And there's never not once a single mention of the fact that Israel has at least 200 of them pointed right at Supreme Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's nose. And as such, it renders the interview sort of an exercise in silliness. Ron and Raleigh asking, did Friedman interrupt President Not Sure over 25 times like Billow? And by the way, why doesn't President Obama ever grant interviews to left-leaning journalists like, say, Amy Goodman? Well, Amy doesn't reach enough people. And there is a presumption that, that frankly, the so-called left, what left, is going to make up its own mind based on the facts and not be necessarily so easily swayed by propaganda. See? Yeah. But this entire interview is conducted, and I mean, we're talking, say whatever you will, Thomas Friedman is put out there into the public sphere as a, as, and this is a term of art, as a public intellectual. Okay? He's got a testimonial. Okay? Remember in The Wizard of Oz, the straw man needed a brain, and the Tin Woodsman needed a heart, and the Cowardly Lion needed courage. But what the wizard explained to the Cowardly Lion was that what he really needed was a testimonial. Well, Thomas Friedman, who, if you recall, during the heady days of the run-up to the slaughter of the people of Iraq, million of them we killed, that's 1/6 of the Holocaust, friends. Thomas Friedman was ever so eager to send other people's children off to die in the filthy meat grinder sands of Iraq, with barely any mention at all, if he could be even bothered to ponder them, of the people who already lived there, who were going to go and meet whatever creator or imaginary friend they had, you know, eminently. Thomas Friedman is a public intellectual. And so, I'm not a public intellectual. I'm a hillbilly with a microphone. But if I, Bob Kincaid, non-public intellectual, non-public and not, well, maybe public, but non-intellectual, can sit here and say and wonder these things, I have to wonder if other people are wondering them too. I mean, even, and this is interesting, even the Iranians know that Bibi Netanyahu has at least 200 nuclear devices pointed at Ali Khamenei's nose. And that's no small nose either. And they won't mention it. Maybe the Iranians won't mention it because the fact that the Israelis have nukes is the whole raison d'etre for why anybody else in the region wants nukes. Maybe it's the fact that Israel has nukes that has destabilized the region in the first place. And so we go through this, and I want to be careful about this because I don't want to be culturally demeaning, but we go through this kabuki theater of pretending that Iran wants nukes because Iran is, wait a minute, crazy persons! And not because the Israeli state has 200 nukes pointed at Ali Khamenei's nose. That's a good question, Jack in Shreveport asking, wouldn't all the rapture-ready folks want for Iran to have a nuke? They don't do that kind of nuance, Jack. And they're so clueless they probably, as Marty referenced the other night, haven't seen Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Well, that's true. That's true. I hope I was not implying otherwise. The angry Indian pointing out, Thomas Friedman cannot be trusted. No, I wouldn't trust him with the silver. I wouldn't trust him with the box of plastic forks either. And yes, he was mighty anxious to have us some war with the Iraq, such as. Asa in Vancouver pointing out, Israel is an awful place to live. Imagine having your trunk popped open and searched through every time you drive into a shopping mall parking lot, or your wife's purse searched through every time you walk into a theater. Yeah. the angry Indian going on saying Friedman is working for somebody. Who that might be is up for debate. I got a pretty good idea. AIPAC? But that's another one of those things that we don't say. So this, I'm sorry, and this is not pro-Israel, anti-Israel, pro-Iran, anti-Iran. This is pro-honest dialogue. Now we're going to sit here and we're going to talk about having peace, but we're not going to talk about the fact that the Uncle Henry over here has a gun pointed at all of us. Doesn't that kind of foul the waters of the discussion? Because, I mean, yeah. So, it just stymied me. Reading this Friedman interview. I won't say I kicked furniture. I'm trying to be a better person. I didn't. But how do you have a meaningful dialogue on this issue and not talk about the fact that Israel is sitting on a bunch of nukes? And then Thomas Friedman writes this on his own hook. The president gave voice, though, in a more emotional and personal way than I've ever heard, to his distress at being depicted in Israel and among American Jews as somehow anti-Israel, when his views on peace are shared by many center-left Israelis and his administration has been acknowledged by Israeli officials to have been as vigorous as any in maintaining Israel's strategic edge. With huge amounts of conservative campaign money now flowing to candidates espousing pro-Israel views, which party is more supportive of Israel is becoming a wedge issue, an arms race, with Republican candidates competing over who can be the most unreservedly supportive of Israel in any disagreement with the United States, and ordinary pro-Israel Democrats increasingly feeling sidelined. Well, that's what a dysfunctional, polarized Congress is best at. The right wing in this country deliberately created, and this goes back to Dim Leader, a with us or against us mentality, in which considered debate and compromise are dirty words. Friedman asked him if President Obama took the criticism of him being anti-Israel personally. And he said, "It has been personally difficult for me to hear expressions that somehow this administration has not done everything it could to look out for Israel's interest. And the suggestion that when we have very serious policy differences, that that's not in the context of a deep and abiding friendship and concern and understanding of the threats that the Jewish people have faced historically and continue to face." I mean, it's true. Not for one micro millisecond has the pipeline with the $3 billion that we send to Israel every year, instead of providing universal health care to our own people, for instance, or instead of running up the food stamp allotment from, say, a dollar a day to, oh my God, three? It's never did, no. It's never halted. It's never slowed down. And like I said, every American worker since 1948, be they Jew, Gentile, Muslim, Hindu, Native American, Buddhist, animist, Wiccan, what have you, every single working American since 1948 has worked not only to provide for the common good of our country, but to prop up Israel as well. Some are okay with that. Some aren't. Some people were happy to pay taxes to support the bombing of Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. Secretly, of course. Some weren't. Some paid their taxes gloriously chanting, USA! 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 And get a brain, morons! As we slaughtered a million innocents in Iraq. And some of us had an issue with that. And yet, this is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of words about an agreement that probably deserves to be ratified, because, after all, what's the other side's option? Kill them! Kill them all! Really, that's really all they got. Because there's no guarantee that there won't be war in this agreement. But there is at least a slightly greater likelihood that there won't be war. On the other hand, however, will the for-profit media delineate it like that? Well, hell no. That's why they're the for-profit media. But that's what this is. This is a clear line of demarcation between pro-war and pro-peace. I muttered APAC after the Angry Indians query, and he said, go deeper. What, Sheldon Adelson? I don't know. But nowhere in this discussion, let's see, this is an interesting quote. We know that a military strike or a series of military strikes can set back Iran's nuclear program for a period of time, but will almost certainly prompt Iran to rush towards a bomb, will provide an excuse for hardliners inside of Iran to say, this is what happens when you don't have a nuclear weapon, America attacks. Which is really quite true. And he says, we know this has become a matter of pride and nationalism for Iran. Even those who we consider moderates and reformers are supportive of some nuclear program inside of Iran, and given that they will not capitulate completely, given that they can't meet the threshold of that Prime Minister Netanyahu sets forth, there are no Iranian leaders who will do that. And given the fact that this is a country that has withstood, and see, this is where he shows that the smartest man in the world thing. Given the fact that this is a country that withstood an 8-year war and a million people dead, they've shown themselves willing, I think, to endure hardship when they consider a point of national pride, or in some cases, national survival. That's an interesting point. What would have happened, and remember, we backed Iraq in the Iraq-Iran war when those million Iranians were killed. What would Saddam Hussein have done if the Iranians had capitulated and said, that's it, it's over, we quit, we surrender, come on in, let's throw you a parade down right down the middle of Main Street in Tehran. Oh, we're all Iraqis now. He could never have governed. And this is political reality. The Israelis can never conquer Iran. Now, they might be able to render it uninhabitable for the next couple of thousand years. But along the way, they might also render the planet uninhabitable for the next couple of, well, ever. And so, the order of the day is a balance of power. But that's not good enough for the right wing in this country, who are, and I would remind you because of the date, morons! These fools in the right wing think that power flows from the muzzle of a gun. That makes them Maoists, you might recall. And they think you can bomb and shoot your way to peace and democracy, which just makes them, you know, morons. but you can read all the way through this thing, all the way to the bottom. And you'll never find a word. I mean, how do they explain that to the president? Oh, by the way, Mr. President, ixnay on awkingtay about the Israeli a uxnay, okay? We've all just got this little parlor agreement that nobody's going to talk about their nukes, even though everybody knows they've got them. And the smartest man in the world points out the other problems in the wider Middle Eastern world. That you've got an entire generation that is rolling at a slow simmer, ready to boil at any minute. Human rights abuses among our friends, you know, those head-lopping Saudis, for instance. A young generation who has nothing but a steady diet of despair. And that is a threat to regional peace as well. And there's something here for the war hawks, too. He said, why is it that the Arab states can't commit ground troops to fight these problems? Why does this have to be something the United States does? Which I think is a valid query. In regard to the other Arab states, he says the biggest threats that they face may not be coming from Iran invading. It's going to be from dissatisfaction inside their own countries. Now, disentangling that from real terrorist activity inside their country, how we sort that out, how we engage in the counterterrorism cooperation that's been so important to our own security without automatically legitimizing or validating whatever repressive tactics they may employ, I think that's a tough conversation to have, but it's one we have to have. Wouldn't you love to hear that phone call? Your serene, noble, majestic, noble graciousness, highness, king of Saudi Arabia, Barack here. Listen, you got to sort out some inequality problems in your own country. We have no inequality problems. If we perceive any inequality problems, we simply lop their heads off. Well, that's what I was talking about. God, how I wish there was no oil under all that sand. We could just leave them alone to lop their heads and, yeah, right. He did manage to make a remark about the treason letter. I do worry that some traditional boundaries in how we think about foreign policy have been crossed. I felt the letter that was sent to the Supreme Leader was inappropriate. I think that you will recall there were some deep disagreements with President Bush about the Iraq War, but the notion that you would have had a whole bunch of Democrats sending letters to leaders in the region or to European leaders trying to undermine the President's policies, I think is troubling. Well, it might have actually been helpful back then, but I get his point. But no, mostly with the exception of a few heroic Democrats like, well, Dennis Kucinich, there just weren't a hell of a lot of people out there pointing out that it was a really stupid idea. Which, of course, made Dennis all the more prescient when it turned out that he was right. So there's a great deal of morality that swirls around this particular issue. No doubt about it. Ron and Raleigh with a little tally for us. Number of Islamic countries the U.S. and Israel have bombed. The U.S. and Israel have bombed 14 Islamic countries and counting. Is that because we're crazy? No. That's because we're the agents of God's wrath. And you know, we can be trusted with nuclear weapons. And that's true. Steve in New York City pointing out, whatever we think of Obama, just listen, Bob, to the difference between this and Dim Leader. Oh, there's no getting around the fact that he is infinitely more intelligent than Dim Leader. But so too is Moldy Bread. There seems to be, though, a concerted effort on the part of Barack Obama not to let, because, come on, he's got to know that his opposition in Washington, D.C. is a bunch of bloodthirsty maniacs. There goes Bob calling names again. What you, if somebody's a bloodthirsty maniac, what do you call them but bloodthirsty maniac? Because the only alternative to this agreement is not having this agreement and instead having war. I mean, even, and he really is, isn't he now? Bibi Netanyahu is just Wile E. Coyote. Super genius. Bibi Netanyahu's idea is, well, you walk away from the table until they're ready to concede some more stuff.
What, Edith, huh? Stifle yourself, Bibi.
But of all the people to really say this, the fact that Dianne Feinstein, Senator from California, said, you know, I've heard Bibi's shtick. I think he needs to shut them up. I mean, she didn't say that exactly, but it translated that way by the time it got back to Tel Aviv. And, you know, if Bibi wants to run the United States, well, come on over. Run for president, Bibi. There's a whole bunch of Americans who'll probably vote for your sorry ass. And don't worry. They won't talk about you. Nah, we only do that for, you know, those kind of presidents, where they were born and stuff. Yeah. Right? Because we wouldn't, well, hell, the only announced presidential candidate, not for long, though, because it's Moran Monday, the only announced Republican presidential candidate wasn't born in the United States. That whole thing seems to be out the window now. So that just seemed, I mean, it seemed like a good place to begin Moran Monday. Because there's a lot of Moranity floating around all of this. But we got lots more Morans. Lots and lots of Morans. Sure do. That having been said, the lines are also open now that the filibuster is over. We've gone through an hour of programming here for this Moran Monday. And you, of course, can always participate any way that you choose. The numbers, well, Harold is 304-574-8178. Maud, otherwise known as the Gizmo line, is 304-663-4676. They're all waiting just for you. Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. Okey-doke? Yeah. Email comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com. And you can reach me at Facebook, Bob Kincaid, and on Twitter, at Bob Kincaid. Really quite, yeah. This is the horn.
Everybody's restless, and they got no place to go. Someone's always trying to tell them something they already know. So their anger and resentment flow. But don't it make you want to drop the roll all night long? Mohammed's radio. I heard somebody singing Sheriff's got his problems too. He will surely take them out on you. In walks the village idiot, and his face is all aglow. He's been up all night listening to Mohammed's radio. Trying to make ends meet. Work all day, still can't pay the price of gasoline and meat. Alas, their lives are incomplete. Don't it make you want to walk the road all night long? Mohammed's radio. Been up all night listening for his trumpet. Open up the righteous, might just come.
Just be right.
I heard the general whispering to his aide-de-camp. Be watchful for Mohammed's land.
Minutes past the hour, the unforgettable Warren Zevon and Mohammed's Radio. It is Moran Monday on the horn, and just a reminder, we have, for those who wandered in late, and it's okay, nobody's chastising or castigating, it happens. For anybody who wandered in late, Ron in Canada has provided very kindly a $75 challenge in response to Gary Labermans having done Have a Moran Monday on Me. And if folks will match that $75, then Ron will double your money. It'll be at $5, $10, $15, $20, all the way up to $75, the first $75 that comes in. Ron will double. PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com, or if you want to do it by the Postal Service, just shoot me a note so we can include it in the total. And that needs, to, well, the postal address, the Horn, checks and money orders, please, no cash. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And, yeah, checks and money orders made payable to the Horn so that Boss Man Wayne can then more easily deal with them. Let's go over and check in with Bill. Are you still there, Bill?
Yeah, I'm still here. How are you?
I'm well. How about you?
I'm fine. I'm not a national socialist tonight, so.
Okay, well, good.
How's that for throwing a different word in there so we don't have to use the other one?
Well, it's the H word.
Yeah. God. Yeah, these folks who I had one of those personal things with Iran when one of the bar owners I worked for, his wife had a brother who was a diplomat in Tehran. He had a visit over there for what, how many days did they hold him? But another story. I mean, it's time for us to start up. But then again, you know, you got the Iranians, and you've got the other guys. We've got, what, Shiite and Sunni? Basically, they're basically Shiites, aren't they?
The Iranians are, and a whole bunch of Iraqis are, too. And then in other parts of that part of the world, there are folks who are minority Shiite living in majority Sunni countries. And, you know, this isn't, as we pointed out in the past, that's not the difference between, say, Methodists and Baptists.
Oh, yeah, in our distant, dark past, all these guys, Christians, they didn't do how good a job was done on the Huguenots in France, or the Irish Catholics versus the didn't the English land a whole bunch of Scots up in there in the north part of Ireland?
I'd say yes.
Yeah, keep an eye on those Irishmen, those Catholics, you know. Oh, and even our early states in this country were somewhat typically geared. Maryland was a Catholic state. And Pennsylvania was Quakers, right? William Penn was not a Quaker.
You would be correct again.
Yeah. And I don't know, Virginia, I'd say Presbyterian, maybe.
Anglican.
Anglican, yeah. Yeah, the High Church of England, yeah. The one that kept a lot of the trappings of Catholicism. So down through the years, people's religion, but like, what is it with these Republicans who want to continue this animosity with Iran? Is it they lost their goddamn oil money and they can't get over it, or what? Is that the problem?
No. I think it's deeper than that. But we may spend the rest of the evening, Bill, trying to figure out where and how deeper it is. Republicans love war. We just have to start with that. They love it because Republicans are usually deeply invested in the defense industry, and that means war is good for business. And as we all remember, and I think should be the national motto instead of "In God We Trust," Calvin Coolidge famously said, "The business of America is business."
Business, yep.
And and if it's good for business, well, that's all that really matters. For instance, we may have very nearly broken the American economy into a million tiny pieces in Dim Leader's misadventure in the sand, but it was great for business. I mean,
for one company in particular.
Blackwater, well, and Halliburton,
I'm talking about Halliburton, yeah.
Yeah. But there were lots of companies that made out like bandits. Well, I think they didn't really make out like bandits. They were bandits.
They were bandits, yeah. Like, what happened to those bushels, those football-sized packages of money that were being thrown around over there? Who got that? I don't think it was the Iraqis who got it.
No. It wasn't. And it certainly... No, I mean, at one point in time, I mean, we admitted at one point in time, Bill, that we were very happily buying off the opposition. If you won't, if you won't shoot at us, if you won't IED us, we'll give you gagging loads of money. And of course, you know, if you're the head of a tribal clan, you're not stupid. You go, I'll take the money, Pat.
And that
more than any stupid ass surge calmed things down. I mean, I'll grant you it did, but it's a hell of a way to fight a war.
Yeah. Why did they do it anyway? I can see why they went in and pushed Saddam out of Kuwait. Okay, because Kuwait had money and oil money that belonged to somebody else anyway. And I heard, from what I've been able to read, the Kuwaitis might have been slant drilling.
That's the general understanding. Yeah, that's kind of the way we frack now.
Yep.
You know, head down a ways and then turn
right.
And then turn left at Albuquerque, and well, there you are, Pismo Beach and all the clams we can eat. Right.
Yeah. I heard a good radio broadcast, you know, old radio, and here was the guest. Was a guy who was a colonel in the New Jersey National Guard, or Highway Patrol, or whatever they called it, you know. And he investigated the Lindbergh baby. And he showed up in Iran sometime in World War II. He might have been around there when the Prime Minister met his end over there, the one the people elected, you know. They elected, what was his name? I'm having a little trouble with some of these names of these foreign leaders.
Oh, Mohammed Mossadegh?
Yeah. We kind of arranged to have him pushed out, and the Shah went back on the old peacock throne there for... And the Shah did some decent things, the education of the country, and anybody he could educate, and he could put them to work and use them, you know. But like so many guys, they sit there forever. They don't have enough sense to take a few sacks of gold and get the hell out of there. That's like some of these South Vietnamese guys. The old story was they came to this country with two paper bags in their hands, two sacks, and they were both full of gold bars. So, I'm a cynic, Bob. It's all about the money, honey. And somewhere along
I don't, the line... No. Hold up. I don't think that qualifies you as a cynic. That qualifies you, Bill, as a realist. I mean, because that's the metric we use in this country. It's all about the money.
Shek's wife was, her brothers were involved in the money markets.
Sure.
Some brothers. I mean, it's all there, but you got to dig out the stuff. It's fallen on me in pieces. Read this book, you'll learn something. Read another book, you'll learn something. And it keeps coming back to the money. Like our own Civil War issue. Slavery is an inhumane situation. But the Southerners felt they needed it to keep their damn cotton going and keep their money coming in. They could give a crap less about anything but money. And in the meantime, they brutalized the whole nation of people who came here and they didn't want to come here. In fact, this one crime author, he talks about the Statue of Liberty in the modern day as like the... the little things are extended to the rest of the world. This is what our attitude is.
Right, yeah.
Towards the rest of the world.
Yeah, never mind the torch. Just give her a new hand with a middle finger extended right there.
Extended, yes. And Netanyahu is a pain in the butt. I mean, my sister-in-law was educated as a nurse and then a doctor in Israel, and she came back here about 5-6 years ago because it was getting just too nasty over there.
Well, I mean, if he was the head of any other country on earth, he would be hunted down, dragged to The Hague, and tried for war crimes.
Well, and Netanyahu seems to hold his... It's that parliamentary form of government where you get a piece of this and a piece of that, and you put them together, and you're the ruling party. We have it here. We have... Each party has its different sections of people. And the Republicans now, so much of their support is coming from the good old Wednesday night crowd, you know. They're going out and casting the vote, and the other guys are counting the money. There was a joke about that when the mafia was involved in Havana. They had the one Jewish guy and my one Italian friend says, "Yeah, we need somebody down there who can handle the money." He's mocking his own connection, you know, ethnic-wise to the mob and to the fact people don't realize there was quite a few guys from New York City in the mob who were not, they weren't Italian. They were just there, too, you know. It's the old story. Money drags in a lot of people, you know.
It's like a magnet.
Absolutely. Well, I won't keep you, but, yeah, you hit it tonight. You were on it because the... You notice that the Saudis are bombing somebody?
Oh, sure. They're bombing Yemen, and the Iranians are bombing ISIL, and the Israelis are sitting back laughing because Arab on Arab violence is always good for Israel.
Yeah. What's the Iranian Air Force flying anymore?
You know, I was thinking about that very thing earlier today, Bill. I love the way your mind works. Because, you know, for eons, they were flying up until the late 70s, they were flying the very latest in American fighter aircraft. I don't know that can't possibly be true because we stopped selling them parts. Well, I don't know. Maybe Ronnie Reagan sold them some parts.
Well, theoretically, we stopped selling. On paper, we stopped selling.
Hey, come on down to Crazy Ronnie's F-14 Emporium. We've got several parted out and up on blocks. You can pick.
Yeah. Well,
I'm Ronald Reagan, and I'm crazy.
The only thing I can think of is Mirages, a French Mirage.
No. I think that insofar as the Russians have been instrumental in some of their nuclear program, I wouldn't be surprised if they're flying MiGs of some sort.
MiGs, yeah.
Which are not exactly shabby aircraft. They're not shabby.
Yeah. Well, I know the Jap. We 1-0 was picked up in one piece on the Aleutians in World War II, and of course, the Americans back engineered that thing. They made mincemeat out of them the rest of the war, you know. Because I don't know where they'd be. Maybe MiGs, but the MiG was a good fighter in the Korean War. They were coming out of Manchuria flying those MiGs called a MiG Alley. And that was, although the kill ratio, from what I've been able to read in Korea, was that the Allies were 13-1 on the so-called communists, if that's what you want to call them. I don't think they're the communist in the nature of what a communist was supposed to be in the beginning of the theory, you know?
Right.
It seems the theories, whether they're religion, their politics, the theories, can really get messed over. Now those guys can quit worrying about making pizzas, huh? Boy, they can sit down and watch a football game on Sunday like everybody else. In fact, they can go to them because they got a ton of money now.
Yeah.
Why can't I think of something like that? But what's the matter with us?
We're just wired the wrong way. We don't have the essential I don't know, the grifter's heart.
Oh, you got it. You sound like a good old-fashioned detective story. Grifter, yeah. That's a good word.
Well, I mean, it fits. I mean, you and I share a common reading list that extends from Dashiell Hammett to Raymond Chandler.
Yeah.
And of course,
line,
yeah, it was a couple of winters back. I went on a John D. McDonald binge.
Well, he is good.
And read all 18 of the Travis McGee's.
Travis McGee, Travis McGee. Yeah, that was he was a character, and I said I like the guy from Detroit. He dedicated his one novel to the big Detroit writer that was real big for a while. And Detroit writer, they called
what?
Him Dutch.
Oh, Mickey Spillane?
Pardon?
Mickey Spillane? No.
No, it's not Spillane.
I know who you're talking about.
Because Warren Esselman wrote for the Detroit Free Press before he started writing detective novels, and he also wrote about four great things about the city of Detroit. And for instance, illegal liquor sales were called blind pigs in Detroit.
You know, that's funny because
they called them that.
In Appalachia, in Appalachia at the turn of the century, they were blind tigers.
Because you know damn well if the cops knew where the booze was and who was selling it.
Sure. Hey, you want to hear a great
prohibition?
Sometimes I get out. Sometimes I get out in front of things, Bill. Last night I watched the first episode of the last season of Mad Men. Because it's been it's been so incredibly popular and blah blah. So I thought, yeah, let's check this out through the miracle of the internet. And I was thinking about, you've read the Travis McGee novels, right?
Yeah, I've read them years ago, yeah.
Well, you know, it starts out in 1964, and John D. McDonald said that he was originally going to name him Dallas McGee in the early draft,
yeah.
But because of the Kennedy assassination, he changed him to Travis. And, you know, there's been Mad Men showed that there is this, for some reason or another, tremendous interest in 1960s, 1970s period TV. I mean, there's just something that it's like looking in on another world. People who live through it go, oh, I remember that, or as happened last night, Agnes said, my mother had one of those. And I said, you know, I think we had those sheets, those bed sheets. Because whoever does the properties for Mad Men is a genius. But I got to thinking, wouldn't it be cool all the good TV, a lot of the good visual entertainment is now made for the pay channels like HBO, Cinemax, what have you. Cinemax has done a brilliant job with a show called The Nick, which begins its second season sometime this summer, and it's set in 1900 New York. And I know, you've got visual problems, but it would blow your mind, Bill. They did a tremendous job with it. But I got to thinking, if somebody out there would buy the rights from the McDonald estate to all 18 of the Travis McGee's,
that'd be a good series. Yeah.
And just bang, 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 bang. Oh, my God. It would be, you remember reading it. They have such continuity from one book to the next.
Yeah. Goodwin does. A good author, yeah.
It's a set decorator's dream because it starts in 1964, and the last book happens in the 80s. Wouldn't that be something? And then to set it all in the scout the locations and everything for for shooting a particular period in time in South Florida. Oh, please!
Well, there's so much that happened that we don't Jimmy Hoffa. Whatever happened to Jimmy Hoffa?
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, if you've seen the movie Hoffa with Jack Nicholson,
yeah,
you kind of know. You know, it's not so much what happened to Jimmy Hoffa, but where happened to Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah. The last he was seen was leaving some bar or restaurant in the Detroit area, and that's...
That was a truck stop, wasn't it? I mean, that's the way it's portrayed in the movie.
It was
a diner or a truck stop or something?
Yeah, it could have been a truck stop, yeah. Because that's what happened. I mean, there's a damn good book called The Traces, The Organization After the Death of Al Capone. And hell, they had a guy working all over the country. The guy that founded Las Vegas, he got shot to death. The guy that was a big organization man behind Vegas.
Oh, Bugsy?
Pardon?
Bugsy Siegel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Bill, you have yourself a very good evening, and we will talk soon,
I hope. Have a good night, and I hope you continue to get some good callers here, and better than me. It's not that difficult to be better than me. Take care of yourself.
Hey, we have a blast, Bill. Don't sell yourself short. You take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy Bill calling from Cleveland, the legendary bluesman, Mr. Stress. And both lines are open. 304-574-8178, 304-663-4676. Remember, that last one spells horn, 304-663-HORN. 8178 doesn't spell anything. I tried. But, I wish I had... I don't know how these things work, but I wonder what the rights to the entire Travis McGee canon would cost. Because it would be so cool. Because they're all good stories, if you like a mystery. They can be a little, you know, a little guyish, right? Let's see here. Hold on. Oh, by the way, speaking of being out in front of the curve, you may recall it was a couple of weeks ago that I'd seen for, God, the umpteenth time that Axe body spray, deodorant spray commercial where the waiter rubs his hand under his underarm. And you know, if I sit down in a restaurant in these last 2 weeks, I look and I wonder if my server has been rubbing their hands under their underarms. And it's just one of those moments where you get out in front of the curve. Because, lo and behold, now Axe has a commercial out. You know, I tweeted it, put it out there, because I'm responsible for this. But, pointing out that that's really kind of a gross image that I really don't want having on any of my brain cells. That my serving person at the restaurant has just recently rubbed his hand under his underarm before picking up my arugula with bacon bits salad or whatever. Mm-mm, no. So now Axe has a commercial where the guy rubs his hand under his underarm, and a woman looks at him and says, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I was just seeing if it was dry." And she said, "Don't. It's gross." Go figure. Yeah. This just in, a visual from our dear friend Peter Godbold, who just celebrated his birthday. Bakery rule. This is on somebody's window. Bakery rule. We do not cater to those celebrating their second, third, fourth, or more weddings. Religious freedom, bitch. Oh, let's see. Let's keep things rolling and run over to the Gizmo line. Hey, is that you, John?
My weekly pontifications.
Well, put your funny House of Whoville hat on and pontificate away.
Well, this reflects the conversation I had some months back where I I was quite successful in alienating an entire room full of people, so I thought it might, and since it was reflective of your conversation today, I thought I would share it.
Oh, goody.
The question came up, do you support the existence of Israel? And I said, no. Shock silence. Why? I said, because you bastards aren't being fair. They're like, what do you mean? I said, well, hell, we ain't going back and giving the Iroquois their lands, and we ain't giving the Cherokee theirs, and God, the handful of Mayas and Incas that are left, they wouldn't mind having a continent or two. I mean, if we're going to go back and fix all the problems of all the disposed and destroyed races and cultures that have occurred over the last couple thousand years, well, we'd be some busy mugs, wouldn't we? And there was a lot of dirty looks and right about, what are they talking about? And I sit back and snicker like that damn cartoon cat, you know. Because, you know, I mean, they have a right to exist now in my eyes, but that's because they're there now. But if I'd have been alive back, say, in the 20s, 30s, when that question came up, and they'd asked that question, I said, no. They've been gone for 2,000 years. Being Jewish is now a thing of a nation state, but back then it was more just a religion. That's what it is. It's a religious identity. It's, you know, and it's just not fair to go back and spend all this money, time, and effort to, you know, sustain the people that were gone for 2,000 years. So that was my thought on the subject.
Well, they're there. And I still maintain that the reality is that they cannot exist on their own. They've got to be propped up with massive infusions of cash from Europe and the United States. And for foreign policy reasons or strategic reasons, we decide that it's good to have a beachhead on the Levant. And our present reality is not particularly well served, John, by saying, well, it should have been this or should have been that. I mean, there were discussions about creating a Jewish state somewhere else, and it probably would have been wiser to do that. But somebody somewhere would have been dispossessed, and that's the problem. I mean, at roughly the same time that Israel was created, you had a mass migration of millions of human beings between partitioned India and what was then referred to as West Pakistan, which is just Pakistan now because East Pakistan became Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. And that was a horrible human rights nightmare.
Yeah, that's the damning thing about this world that we live in right now is that, you know, it's like I say, I travel in the South a lot, and I hear a lot of that dominionist conception.
And that's the part John, that's the part that creeps me out the most, is because I know what evangelical fundamentalism is about, and because I know what millennialism is about, and because I sat in the pew as a child and heard half-educated lunatics hooting on and on and on about, you know, when Jesus finally comes back. I know that the understanding that these Protestants have is on that great getting up morning, Jesus is somehow going to miraculously make all the Jews, poof, pop up in one place. And he's going to say, one last chance, babies, one last chance. Confess that I'm Messiah or you're all toast. Only he's not going to reach out his magic laser finger and go, bzz, bzz, bzz. No. The millennialists and post-millennialists and pre-millennialists and rapture-ready crowd are told that they are personally going to get to put Jews to the sword. And even saying that makes my stomach flop. I find that sickening. Because And maybe like, you know, the really nice Christians who go to their little Episcopal churches on Sunday, and the friendly little Midwestern Lutherans who go on Sunday and they have bake sales, and maybe they don't know this, but they need to, John. They need to. There is an essential nugget of genocidal mania inside, baked in, if you will, to evangelical Christianity.
Well, yeah, they got a freaking glass jar with a picture on it that says donate money. A good chunk of the financing that those settlements have in they call it the West Bank, but you get the different parts of what they call the settlement areas that are the settlement. Their ideology is that in order for Jesus to come back, Israel has to be the same size, the same land, the same territory as it was defined in the Bible. And so they keep sending money, and this jackass Netanyahu, he supports...
Oh, look,
politics.
I remember when Pat Robertson was so excited because he was going to build a theme park. People think I'm kidding. I'm not. Pat Robertson was going to build a theme park, you know, with a Jesus water slide and everything, which goes back to Sam Kennison, peace be upon him, saying he wanted to be there on Judgment Day to hear Jesus look at Jim Baker and Jerry Falwell saying, "Where did I say to build a water slide?" There were going to be crucifixion nail corn dogs and shit like that. And it was all good to go, and it had the blessing of the Israeli government, because see, the Israeli government and the Israelis are kind of, you know, by virtue of being agnostic about Yeshua in the first place, they're like, well, if that's what they believe, whatever, you know, we'll, any port in a storm, we need all the friends we can get. Looks like we got the fundies. Oh, well. We'll worry about whether they're going to put us to the sword when Jesus comes back. He's never coming back. forgetting, of course, that they might decide he'd come, there's a branch of them that say that he'll come back after they've killed enough Jews. Never mind. But Pat Robertson was all ready to go with his theme park when he suddenly caught a case of verbal diarrhea and declared that Ariel Sharon had been stricken with a stroke because God was angry at him, and then whoop, there went the theme park. But there's, you know, there's other stuff. For instance, there was the fundies who were out there sponsoring a genetic lab to breed a pure red heifer, and I don't even understand what all this has to do with anything, but it has something to do with rebuilding the temple, and that's the other thing that they get all worked up about. You know, if we could just get it on enough that somebody could blow up the Dome of the Rock, the Jews could rebuild the temple, because Jesus can't come back till the temple gets rebuilt either. And the Antichrist, and I know this sounds like some sort of hallucination or a Pink Floyd record playing backwards or something, but the Antichrist rebuilds the temple. And therefore you've got to have, remember when Titus finally had as much out of him as he could stand and destroyed the temple, the Arch of Titus in Rome contains sculpture showing them carrying the really special menorah from behind the really special curtain in the temple through the triumph that he received in Rome for winning the Jewish war. All that stuff is gone, got melted down, part of some queen's crown now, God knows. I often wonder what happened to all the gold in the world and the silver that, like, got, but never mind. So you've got all that as back. So you got to have all the temple tableware. I mean, you got to, well, it wouldn't be shrimp forks because, you know, get taken outside the city gates and stoned to death for eating shrimp. But no, you got to have all the gizmos and the gadgets and the bells and the incense sensors and the right. And there's a Christian fundamentalist group out there that is funding the making of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it is just crazy.
know, they, it amazes me that these people with their, this incredibly strong belief that they, and yet they're so limited in their thought process that they think if this Jesus guy existed, that he would, that they could manipulate the event by, you know, breeding heifers or by funding settlements and stuff, as if somehow that they could bring it on to their timetable. And I mean, you know, I'm, call me weird, but if I was Jesus, I'd be going, I was gonna come, but y'all a bunch of assholes, so I'm not bothering. I'll stay up here.
Well, you know, I still, I go back to, and this joke has been done by a million different comedians, but the first one that I know of was Dick Gregory, who many years ago said, do you really think Jesus is going to want to come back and see people walking around with crosses around their necks? Oh, no, Dad. Nuh-uh. I went the first time. You said it'd be on. No, I'm not going back. Look at them. They think it was a good thing. That hurt.
Yeah.
Bill Hicks picked up on it and said, that's like suggesting, and she was still alive at the time, and Bill Hicks, the prophet, peace be upon him, said people wearing crosses is like showing up to a party at Jackie Kennedy's house wearing a necklace with a rifle with a scope on it around your neck.
Yeah. I mean,
just remembering John, Jackie, see?
These people are just, there's a sickness out there. It's just incredible. I mean, you know, it's like yesterday, you know. I mean, being Easter and being the truck stops and stuff, yeah, I got a whole big dose of the whole, you know, after Easter, let's go to the truck stop and eat some good food and then go in there and, I mean, holy sandbox, hell, I mean, these guys are walking around all glazed, eyes glazed, everybody in there dressed up in their finery and everything, and, you know, they'd come up to me and, you know, did you go to church today? No. Why not?
Didn't go yesterday, ain't going tomorrow.
I said, because I don't believe in that stuff. And they were like, what do you mean you don't believe in that stuff? I mean, it's Easter, and, you know, Christ comes back. And I'm like,
great pumpkin and all that.
Yeah, you know, so I'm like, great. You know, I said, send me an invite when he does. And it just, it was like getting a massive.
Well, and that's another thing. In Appalachia, as often, more often than not, and our other Appalachian members, Horned and Eastas, can attest to this, and I think it probably spreads out into the Midwest. Maybe Carol can tell us. But Easter. What's Easter dinner? On the evangelical fundamentalist table, what is the centerpiece of Easter dinner? Now, in the Orthodox world and in the Roman Catholic world, it will often be lamb. Because, of course, and talk about some twisted imagery, because Jesus is the Lamb of God, so therefore we're going to slaughter a lamb and eat it. I know. But among your evangelical fundamentalists, what is the centerpiece meal of Easter dinner?
Good day.
Ham. Mo Liberal was right there. Ham. Pork. You know, because we're just going to really stick a finger in the eye. Because there's a story back, you know, where... The way they get around it, because they had to make Christianity tolerable to the Greek and Roman world, so there's this vision that one of them has where all this stuff is presented to the person having the hallucination, and it's, yeah, but that's unclean, Lord. And he says, nope, I made it. It's clean enough for you. Have a barbecue. And so consequently, especially in places affected by Southern culture, ham on Easter.
Well, I mean, they take it. They want their cake and eat it too, as it were, because and the exact passage I can't remember exactly which passage it is, but one of the key elements in the Bible is that Jesus says that I am here to essentially invalidate all that happened before. This is the New Testament.
It's called the New Covenant. The New Covenant.
Yeah, the New Covenant. And yet you have people talking about Leviticus all the damn time, about how, well, you have to gaze or this and that, something else. And I'm like, you guys don't even read your own damn book. He said specifically that all that was before is no longer valid. It's no longer there. And yet these people want to go and pick and choose, cherry pick all the little bits and pieces they want, and then shove it down your throat. And it's like this whole thing with Israel. Israel exists not because of the Jews, but because of the Christians. They want it there. They think that,
because someday they're going to get to gig everybody who's there who won't say, yep, Jesus is Savior.
Mm-hmm. And that's,
obviously it's a thought experiment, but if I were Jewish, I would find that very disturbing.
Oh, I've talked to people from Israel that have nothing but damn contempt for Americans and the way we think, particularly the evangelicals. You know, the Knesset, which is the Jewish government and their parliamentary system, has an enormous spectrum of people in that government. You have your hard right.
Well, no, it is possible, and this is a fact. There is a more vigorous, viable debate about foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel in Israel than there is in the United States. In the United States, anybody who ever delivered a cold cup of coffee to Alan Dershowitz is an anti-Semite.
That does make a lot of sense, because, when the rare times when that conversation rolls around, like I said, back in the 80s when I used to work in politics, you couldn't swing a dead cat anywhere around Capitol Hill without slapping that backside of AIPAC or Friends of Israel or some other horse mess they were jagged deep. And it's like Bill was talking about with the whole Kuwaiti thing. You know, I was there. I was working in D.C. and what a lot of people don't know and don't really think about, because, Garris being mostly diplomacy, it was happening kind of behind the scenes. But the Kuwaiti royals and the representatives of the plant oil companies were like ants crawling over Capitol Hill weeks before Hussein invaded, because they knew the song and dance was coming in the pike, and they transferred tens of billions of dollars into D.C. And for like a month and a half before the actual invasion occurred, those little bastards were scurrying all around with big plastic, with little sandwich bags full of money going into one congressman's office, one senator's office, showing up at various lobbying groups and stuff like that. Hell, even our guys were asked to write a paper on it. The geopolitical effects of the loss of Kuwait to blah blah blah, and the economic impact of the oil destabilization monitoring. There was a huge name of the title of paper that they did, and I barely understood half of it. But the place was greased to an incredible extent, because a lot of people forget that Saddam Hussein was our boy over there. He was the one. He was being used to fight Iran. They spent 8 years with us.
Right, which is the very perceptive part of what Obama said. We're talking about people who absorbed a loss of a million people and kept right on.
Yeah. You know, these people live in a world that, one of the scariest, you know, if you look at the demographics over in that part of the world, we're in for a penny in for a pound. Because the population of Saudi Arabia, the population of Bahrain, the population of the Arab Emirates, all these people, they cannot feed their own people with their own resources. The only thing they can do is import food and other materials into the country because they're it's a desert region. They can't, they have a very hard time putting food on the table. And, if that part of the world blows up, you're talking humanitarian crisis unlike any that we've ever seen.
Well, and it's good to remember that it has not always been that way. For instance, we had the story last week of the 5,500-year-old beer brewing operation that was Egyptian that was unearthed in Tel Aviv recently. And a lot of, remember, irrigation was invented in Mesopotamia, as far as we know, I think. And one of the things that comes with irrigation is salination. You will eventually, by irrigating with fresh water, you will eventually, if I understand correctly, ruin your own soil because it'll become salty. I'm not quite sure how that works, but then again, I don't understand why there are hydrocarbons on the moons of Jupiter either, when there were no organics there. I guess hydrocarbons can exist without dinosaurs. But anyway, a lot of that land has been ruined over the millennia. A lot of it was desert, but a lot of it has been ruined over the millennia. And in point of fact, I can't look at, because John, I am the ancient history geek nerd that I am, I can't look at this whole dynamic without considering the ebb and flow and march, if you will, of history. And it was, the Achaemenid dynasty of Persia, which had unified much of that part of the world, and the Persian king would send an emissary to a place and demand a gift of earth and water. And by providing earth and water, you came under the vassalage of the king of kings, Darius, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, Cyrus, what have you. And that's where that scene, that stupid scene in that incredibly stupid movie 300, where the guy who walks around naked except for a pair of leather panties and a cape says, "This is Sparta!" after he throws the Persian down the well. Well, that's rooted in the fact that the Persian emissaries came over and said, "We need some water and some earth for the king of kings here, and then we'll leave you alone." And they said no. And the Athenians said no. And some of them said yes, and that's how you wind up with things like Thermopylae and Marathon. And then eventually along comes Alexander with vengeance on his mind. He crosses the Hellespont and marches down through. And look, the first place he winds up is the Levant. He goes and sacks Tyre. They said it couldn't be done, but he did it anyway. And the race was on, and you get the battle of the, I can't remember the name of the river, and then you get the battle of Gaugamela, and the Persian king is on the run and winds up getting killed by his own people. But guess what happened? Alexander marched his happy Macedonian ass over there, and found out he couldn't govern any of it. He had to have the people who already lived there in order to be able to govern. Now, meanwhile, that's working west to east, working east to west. Everybody and their cousin conquered Israel. I mean, it's like you really weren't a respectable empire until you'd gone over and given Israel a righteous stomping. And look, that's 5,000 freaking years of history, and it forms the national paranoia that is Israel. Because if it ain't the Babylonians, it's the Syrians. If it ain't the Syrians, it's the Assyrians. If it ain't the Assyrians, it's the Persians. Because everybody comes over and stomps Israel.
Well, you can't, I mean, if you think about it, look at its geographic location. It's sitting on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean.
Everybody wants some beachfront property. But the reality of it was, is that you went to the ocean and turned left to get to Egypt. And so places like Gaza and places where Tel Aviv is, these were places where the Egyptian culture was extending its sphere of influence up to the point that it became uncomfortable for other people who pushed back through the same region. And that's why I'm surprised that instead of, you know, if you drill down far enough in Israel, instead of hitting oil, I'm surprised you don't just hit gushers of blood. Because the whole area is just soaked. I'm surprised it's not a blood swamp. Because it just happens to be where everybody who hated each other wound up running into each other.
It's the crossroads of the world. You know, that's been the history of that part of the world forever and ever. And it had the other thing is it had the misfortune of being this the fertile ground of the Abrahamic religions. And
yeah, and that's, you know, that's another entire bit of madness. But bless his gone heart, wherever he is or isn't. I remember all those issues when Bart Kopp would talk about, really, can't we just give the Israelis Oklahoma? I mean, and he would go on at length talking about how Oklahoma was every bit as awful as Israel in terms of crummy real estate. And he said, we tried it once with the Cherokees, and, well, you know, they're still here. Maybe we can give a big chunk of Oklahoma to the Israelis. I mean, wouldn't you rather live in Oklahoma and have your children grow up safely than live in Israel and die for sacred sand? Or make somebody else die for sacred sand? And poor Bart Kopp used to just get unmitigated hell for saying that. You know, I mean, there's not a hell of a lot of people living, there weren't a hell of a lot of people living in Baja California in 1948. Really? We couldn't have talked the Mexicans into giving up that peninsula? Beachfront property.
Yeah, remember, Bob, that part of the world now is being owned by the uber rich. They got their little colonies down there.
Well, of course. I mean, Muffy and I were just down at Cabo not terribly long ago at all, and you know, we had a fabulous time.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, they apply for disaster relief when that last hurricane went flopping through there and tore off their $1 billion roofs. But you know, we won't talk about that. But yeah, that's. You know, it's a fascinating conversation. I mean, it's in our little lives, I consider myself a little life. You know, it's sometimes fun to just sit back and look at the absolute madness of people fighting over, you know, you talked about desalination. Well, by and large, that's how Israel gets its fresh water. Not like they have an overabundance of rivers in that country. So they get 40, I think the last I read it was like 40% of their water. And there's a group of Californians now that are going over to Israel to look at how they do their water desalination. They're thinking they're going to have to come back over here and do the same thing here in California. So that's another little ripple in the time stream. But these Republicans sitting up there in Congress right now, they have got, I mean, they are literally bumping their head against the wall trying to figure out how they get a damn war on, so particularly if they can blame it on Obama.
Yeah, I think what he's saying to them is that, because there's an answer here. And if the right wing were half the constitutional scholars that they bill themselves as being, and I hate to even, I'm a little bit nervous about even mentioning this, John, because I don't want to, you know, well, you know, Fields' third commandment, don't smarten up a chump. But look, the answer is pretty clear. constitutionally, if they want a war so goddamn bad, the Congress is constitutionally empowered to declare war on Iran or Costa Rica or Liechtenstein.
Yeah, but
I mean that is a sure enough Article 2 or legislative, is it Article 2? Legislative power. That's a power of the legislative body of Article 1. I can't remember. Oh, now I got to look it up. Somebody will tell me in the chat room. Why can't? Wow, that's amazing that I would put that on a brain cell that I would later kill. But anyway, that's a power. You know, now the president can go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war. But if the Congress declares war, the president has no choice but to wage it. At least the way the Constitution's written. So if these bloodthirsty MFers in the Republican Party want a war so damn bad, it's a lot easier than sitting there talking about that Kenyan who won't fight people because he's a big sissy man in mom jeans. You get a resolution up, you vote on it, you pass it over to the Senate, or the Senate passes it to the House, and if the damn thing passes both houses, congratulations! War!
Yeah, but then you have to take responsibility for it, and Republicans do not like taking responsibility for crap. Because they know damn well that the American people, we don't want it. And that's the thing.
Right, so they have to gin up some casus belli that says, well, you know, we hate having ourselves a war. How's my portfolio doing? Really? It's up? Good. We hate having ourselves a war, but those pesky, tricky, inscrutable Iranians, well, you know, they just won't play ball, and we're just going to have to kill a few of them.
Yeah, well, you know, they're going to try one time, and it's going to bite them in the ass.
Well, didn't it already do that in Iraq? I mean, isn't part of this problem the fact that we are not, you never know when you're dealing with morons. I've seen comment threads where morons are saying, yeah, but we succeeded in Iraq. So damn ain't there no more, are they? They ain't no more weapons of mass destruction, is they? Huh? Any more talk about aluminum tubes in the Iraq and such? Yeah, USA, we won. God damn.
Oh, yeah.
A bunch of liberals.
You know, we won all right. Yeah, sure. But the only problem is in nowadays, when you fight a war, you got more than. It's not like in the old days when you went out with your fancy, nice spick and span suit and your trusty musket. You all stood in line and went out to. And actually went and talked to the local farmers and said, which field are you not using this year? Oh, that one over there. Okay, well, that's the one we'll go fight in. And they go fight the little battle, and the villagers sit up on the hilltop and take bets on who's going to win. And then when the battle's over, you go home. Not anymore. Now, if you go fight a big-ass war, especially for America, we end up having to go and foot the bill to rebuild your ass. You know, we bombed Germany back almost into the frickin' Stone Age, and then what do? We spend up teen billions of dollars and got them rebuilt, and they were dutifully grateful. And Japanese, we bombed them all to hell, and then spent
and gave them the two most dynamic economies on Earth.
Yep.
I mean, one of the things that impressed me about Germany was that there, just in the 2 or 3 weeks I was there, just running around the country a little bit, there's a lot about Germany that makes me think that it's the America we wish we were.
Without a doubt. I mean
they won't tolerate a pothole in the highway. On the other hand, if a couple of people are in a park and they happen to be, you know, getting it on, cops won't bother you. Now, if you're double parked or your meter's over the limit, no, we got a problem. Because that's an assault on order. But plenty of commercialism. Plenty of localism, good senses of community. It's like America in the late it's like America in the mid 1960s with better technology. Yeah. Hey John, good talking to you, and
all right.
Hopefully we'll carry the conversation further. Drive safe, my friend. Our buddy John calling from the road. Let us go over to Harold, the Harold line, the Maud line, the Gizmo line, 304-663-4676 is now open. This is what we call the Skype line, and somewhere in Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hey.
This is Flavio. How are you?
I'm well, Flavio. You?
I just wanted to put in my two cents to nominate... another moron. I don't know. I missed the first hour, so I don't know if you mentioned this. The Georgia teacher that told students that...
Oh, Jesus, no. I'm glad you brought her up. This is rich.
If they voted for Obama, she also challenged the students to prove their Christianity. This was on Alternet. A Georgia teacher whose husband sits on the school board is under fire for telling her students that President Barack Obama isn't a Christian, and if their parents voted for him, they're not Christians either. Okay? And then, you know, the NAACP got in, they had a meeting, her husband who sits on the school board attended the meeting, and, you know, all kinds of improprieties there. But what came to mind at the at that time, I was, you know, my brain just short-circuited at that point, and I thought, wait a second, leading up to the election, they didn't like his pastor, Jeremiah Wright, because, you know, Palm Sunday sermon in 2003, Goddamn America. And Jeremiah Wright was a Marine. You know, I think he fought in Vietnam.
Yeah, walk the walk. Talk the talk, yeah.
He said some choice things about American imperialism, the genocide of the Indians, the intervention of the Philippines, Latin America, the Middle East, you know, and that's, you know, that... But everybody just played that snippet, Goddamn America, and then, you know, Obama being who Obama is, threw him under the bus.
Well, you know, it's not that far from something that I said a long time ago, and that is, you know, every president ends every speech by saying, God bless America. You know, if we were really, really earnest and serious about having ourselves a state religion, that wouldn't be God bless America. Flavio, that would be God forgive America. Because we've got an abundance of things to still be begging forgiveness for. We've got a genocide of indigenous people that we're going to be a long time begging forgiveness for if anybody's into that. We've got slavery, and of course the right wing. Oh, they always got to bring up slavery. That ain't been real, sir. 150 years. Well, that doesn't mean that the stench of the sin does not persist in the nostrils of the Almighty.
But I was thinking of the double standard. Is he a Christian, or is he going to be a Christian, or is he going to be a Kenyan Muslim socialist? Make up your mind, you know? First they didn't
he's
like
a Muslim,
because of his pastor.
He's a Muslim Christian. Now, see, you can have those in a moron's brain experiences no cognitive dissonance whatsoever when contemplating the fact that the president is a Muslim Christian. But no, he's the worst kind. He's really a Muslim because he wears his Muslim ring, and you know it's got a secret decoder in it, and there's Muslim and he gives Muslim gang signs, and he went to one of them Muslim schools, but see he pretends to be a Christian, which is a false Christian, which means he really hates Jesus a lot. And that's how their minds work.
I'm thinking of chapter 72 of Mark Twain's autobiography, the old one, the one that was kind of expunged.
Yeah.
But there was that chapter, I think this was chapter 72. He's at the meeting of dignitaries, kind of like the White House press club of his age, and there's all kinds of dignitaries, military, you know, and whenever I guess the theme of the chapter was when the Anglo-Saxon wants something, he just takes it, and that would stir the crowd up. And I don't know if you remember that, but he goes, our trade dollar worth 60 cents, you know, in our trade dollar, he says, in God we trust. That's our public motto. Our private motto is, come, step lively.
Well, that's only because Calvin Coolidge hadn't become president yet and declared the business of America as business. Twain would have adored that, Flavia.
I love Mark Twain. I think I've read everything he's ever written. And I need to get a hold of the University of California autobiography of Mark Twain. I don't know. I guess the second volume came out in 2014, and there's a third volume on its way.
Yeah. Yeah. And wow.
And you know why? You know why that is, right? Because he instructed his executors not to release that stuff until 100 years after his death. You know, just to spare his family, you know.
Well, no, with things like Letters from the Earth, and in particular The War Prayer, that was published after his death because his longtime friend and editor said, Clemens, we can't publish this. You're an American treasure. You're an icon. You're revered. You're beloved. And they'll hate you on the spot for this. And, of course, there has never been a stronger piece of anti-war writing than Mark Twain's The War Prayer.
Oh, no. Nah. My late English professor at the University of Wisconsin.
On Wisconsin, by the way.
How's that?
I said, on Wisconsin.
On Wisconsin, yes, tonight. He did a reading of it on me for me on tape. I still have that, and it's so powerful. My God, is The War Prayer ever so powerful? The most incredible piece of writing. I read it when I was in college, and I was in tears. It was like, man, that's good.
And you know, you get there. You learn something with Twain. And that is that there is no person more disappointed than someone who has figured out that the whole faith game is a racket.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Twain maintains a relationship with some notion of the divine all the way to the end, but he's given up on the idea of any order or sense or decency to it. I think the person who most admirably picks that torch up and carries it on into the future is Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
You know, there's a bright straight line between Mark Twain and Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, yeah. They even looked alike. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut had the bushy hair, the mustache, and the white suit.
Oh, I think that was cultivated. He because he wrote a long time ago that he didn't have heroes, but the one hero he had was Samuel Clemens.
Oh yeah, and Twain was so disgusted with imperialism. I mean, he wrote about the Jolo massacre, you know, the Morro massacre, you know, that crater where the soldiers from atop the crater shot 630 men, women, and children, you know, to death. You know, with a grape shot, you know.
Right.
And he wrote about the Philippines, I guess. One of my favorite essays.
Well, the Philippines inspired The War Prayer.
Yeah, and one of my favorite essays to this day, and I've read it several times, is To the Person Sitting in Darkness.
Yeah.
Good Lord. And he finishes the essay suggesting that we ought to have, you know, two flags, you know, the usual one with the stars and stripes, and then what did he suggest? To change the the white stripes to black and put a Jolly Roger where the stars are.
Well, and you know, and that's because he saw
Jolly Roger's the skull and crossbones.
Yeah, yeah, he's writing that during the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh yeah, he hated Theodore Roosevelt.
And you know, he saw American imperialism as a form of piracy, which is interesting because in a very short time, a young man by the name of Smedley Butler. And remember, Smedley Butler is in the United States Marine Corps by the time that Twain is writing to the person sitting in darkness, and Butler later writes in War as a Racket how he was, you know, he was an enforcer, he was a hitman.
He's a muscle man.
Yeah.
He's a muscle man for big corporations. He made China safe for, you know, the American.
Made Nicaragua safe. Doesn't he say that he made Nicaragua safe for United Fruit?
United Fruit and Tampico safe for Standard Oil.
Yeah. Flavio, it's awfully good to talk to you, and I hope you have a good evening, and, yeah, on Wisconsin.
Can I just add one more thing?
You sure can.
Speaking of Smedley Butler, you know that the Nobel Prize-winning author Sinclair Lewis wrote a wonderful, wonderful novelette, It Can't Happen Here, about, you know, the resurgence of fascism and, you know, but that, people don't know, that was based on a real story. They wanted to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They went to Smedley Butler with a plan, and Butler, who was no traitor, went to the Congress and denounced the, you know, the, what they call the cocktail coup, you know? I don't know if you.
No, I'm familiar with all of that. And then it was promptly, it was said that he was crazy, paranoid, delusional, whatever. And, shortly thereafter, he was more or less cashiered. He should have been made commandant of the Marine Corps by tradition, but instead he was not because it was said that he was unstable. You know, the Soviet Union and the United States have that in common. If somebody upsets the apple cart, they'll say that he's nuts and send him away.
The squeaky wheel always gets the grease, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, you have yourself a good night. It's been a productive conversation.
Well, I'm glad I enjoyed it as well, Flavio. Do take care, and here's hoping spring arrives up there sometime soon.
And go Badgers.
On Wisconsin. We're from, well, we can say that. It's the end. Fuck 'em, Bucky.
Buck 'em, Bucky.
Later, Flavio.
Later, bye.
Bye now. And by way of a little bit of backstory, I know. Our buddy Scott in Sweden said no spoilers, but there's no getting around this. Just because, you know what you're not hearing out of the Commonwealth of Kentucky right now? That a bunch of people were gunned down in the streets. Because, see, there was a riot in Lexington. Night before last. It was a white riot. And it was a riot over a basketball game. And stuff was set on fire in the streets, and the privileged white children were very, very upset. But nobody was gunned down by police. They didn't. I don't think they rolled in the Pentagon provided Ferguson special. There were no snipers up on vehicle roofs looking at mommy and daddy's precious baby through crosshairs or anything. Because, well, you know, white folks can be trusted to riot after a basketball game, right? Hey, look, it's the angry Indian. What's happening, Angry?
Hey, my man, what's going on?
I don't know. Riots, Kentucky. Whatever.
Yeah, but like you just said, you know, white riots are okay, and, you know, when they're rioting to defend an enabler of a pedophile in state of Pennsylvania, you know, that's okay, and riots over pumpkins, you know, that's okay. Yeah, you know, you're able to do that in the United States.
Yeah, because America.
Yeah, America. And you know, a lot of what you've been talking about in terms of the funding of the Israeli state and or the Jewish state in the Levant, you know, that's what I think it should be called, because they're making an ethnic claim. They're making an ethnic
argument. You mean JSIL?
Yeah. You know, I still use that term. You know, people are, oh, that meme is pastorate. I'm like, no. It's appropriate because, you know, when you really look at what the hell is going on, and when you listen to Netanyahu, I mean, he's been saying the same thing since 1981. And
I mean, is it me or is that guy nuts?
No, he's not crazy. He's just saying that, you know, whatever he needs to say to do whatever it is, you know, their particular agenda is, which changes. I mean, they're...
But, I mean, after things like Gaza, if that guy had been Serbian, there would be a worldwide manhunt on for him.
Well, look, if the state of Israel was a human being, you know, because in the United States, corporations are people, but if the state of Israel was a human being, it would be put away. It would be prosecuted and probably, you know, you know, to the fullest extent of human law. You know, but it's okay, though, because it is a white colonialist state, and because it is a white colonialist state, it will be supported by the West. Because they're white colonialist states.
Outremer, man. Outremer.
You know, and Zionism, and I hate to say this, because a lot of people who do not understand the history of it, you know, they might know a little bit about Theodor Herzl, you know, but they don't really know the entire story.
Theodor Herzl?
Who? What?
Yeah.
Herzl?
No. Herzl? Oh. What? Yeah, no.
Oh,
okay, no.
I get it. Yeah. I mean, in all seriousness, you know, what we understand as political Zionism is mostly an Eastern European, you know, thing. And historically speaking, they have always, as a political group, you know, went to the, with the German Kaiser, you know, they went to the Tsar with this in Russia. We will back up whatever colonialist program you have going on anywhere in the world, provided you allow us to go there and develop it. We'll do whatever the hell you want. They've tried to make this deal before. They did it in Uganda under Britain. You know, they tried it with Poland. You know, they've had several, you know, different communities. And Germans, you know, Aryan, I shouldn't say really Aryan, because, you know, that's something else that they ripped off.
Yeah, that's another whole, bogus.
Yeah, you know, that whole Teutonic black sun, the pure German, you know, Ubermensch sort of thing. There are still two communities, one in Brazil and I think the other one in Uruguay, where this genetic experiment to create the perfect, European, you know, the pinnacle of European society, culture and genetics, to create the perfect society that would then take over the planet.
You know, the problem is every time you get one of those, somebody goes sneaking off to the servant quarters, and there goes your master race.
Well, if you're going to believe the Bible, with Zionists who were founded by Herzl, who was an atheist, but they will use, you know, Netanyahu will use religion. What did he say? I forgot what year it was. God gave us Israel. This is our land, right?
Yeah.
And he got biblical for about 6 or 7 months. And then, you know, whatever works. But the point is...
Well, didn't he say that during the Bush administration?
He has mentioned it every now and again, but there was a particular period where he used that as a
term. Well, I mean, I only say that because George was running around talking about God telling him to invade Iraq. And
which is funny because his father seems to be a practicing atheist, and he cut Israel's money at one point for the settlement expansion because he's like, look, this isn't helping anything but antagonizing a problem that's already bad, and I'm not supporting this. And he was only in term once. You know, there are still Jewish Americans who do not like, you know, they have a problem with Pappy Bush because of that single thing alone, that and Jonathan Pollard. You know, if we're going to talk about spying, and, you know, we can get into the USS Liberty, right? You know, I mean, we can get into a whole lot of things. And yes, what you're saying is, you know, common knowledge outside of the United States that Israel is a nuclear power, and everybody knows this. Everybody knows that.
Well, I think it's common knowledge in the Congress and the White House, too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's common knowledge for them. I'm talking about the average person on the street. No,
I mean,
you know,
didn't Mordecai Vanunu kind of drop the dime on the whole charade?
Yeah, and we saw what happened to him. He was set up by Mossad, and he's still paying the price. He's paying a heavy price for, you know, basically trying to stop things from getting a hell of a lot worse. I mean, this whole geopolitical play is, you know, like my wife said this morning, it's very goddamn confusing. And even though I understand a lot of the details, it's only confusing because, you know, countries have permanent interests. And, you know, the United States is so, you know, xenophobic and so centered upon itself, it doesn't realize that. Because the way that most people here look at it, whatever's being done is for the United States' interests because that's just the way it's supposed to be and that's just it. And, you know, yes, the United States is supporting the state of Israel. If the United States did not support the state of Israel would cease to exist. Not because of Hamas, not because of Hezbollah, not because of Iran, not because of Jordan, but because they would not be able to afford to do what the hell they're doing. You know, the water, they use everything that's there, right? You know, you see some, when you look at various tourist films of Israel, especially in the settlements, you see lush gardens.
Yeah. Oh, no, if you sit just about any Sunday in a Baptist church anywhere in the South, sooner or later Israel will come up and they'll say, they have turned the desert into a blooming garden.
Yeah.
They have. Bless Jesus, they have.
Yeah, but they never tell that congregation, though, that they paid for it. Just like when I was watching Saving Private Ryan, I remember really getting angry and wanting to get my money back, because the first 10 minutes of the film, you know, I was sitting there and I said to the person I was with, I said, you know, I wonder how many people in this audience realized that the bullets that these American soldiers were being shot with were being paid for by American taxpayers, because you know the armament, besides Krupp steel and whatever the hell else was going on, you know, the war profiteers that have been making money since World War I in Europe. How many Americans, like the Bush family and DuPont, were invested in the Nazi Party?
Yeah, there is that, isn't there?
You know, and we never
IBM, Henry Ford, Bush family, yeah. Brown Brothers, Harriman.
Yeah. Cui Bono, who's benefiting from this? I mean, al-Nusra is an al-Qaeda affiliate. Al-Nusra fighters who are being injured fighting the Islamic State are being treated in the state of Israel. They're not being detained by the state of Israel. They're not being tortured by the state of Israel. They're being treated so they can go back and fight. And you were talking earlier, or somebody had mentioned that, you know, President Obama hasn't been able to speak to too many left-wing things. And, yeah, I would love him to sit with Amy Goodman. But, yeah, you're right. He's not going to get that gig. Or he's not going to offer her that gig. But he did go to Vice News, and he went to the Huffington Post, which are both internet-based. And basically said the same thing. If it wasn't for the Iraq war to begin with, we wouldn't be dealing with the Islamic Front. Just like if it wasn't for, you know, the way that Afghanistanian communism was dealt with by MI5, by, you know, we're going to assume the CIA, the Russians would never have come in. And then we wouldn't have the Mujahideen, which became al-Qaeda. All of these things are, you know, the moneyed interests in the world are trying to control, you know, are basically trying to, you know, do whatever it is that they want to do at a particular time because it benefits them at that particular time. But the rest of us are dealing with the blowback of this, which is their term, not mine. And every time Israel does what it does, whether it's Operation Castlet, whether it's Operation Pillar of Cloud, or whatever name they want to use, you know, they have totally, you know, led to the destabilization of that entire region. And then if you're going to talk about Iran, it's a fair thing to say. It doesn't have to be pro-Iran to say this. It's a fair thing to say because it's accurate. Iran has done nothing to the United States. And if you look at the 1953 coup, and then if you look at the creation of the Sabak, and if you look at how the Shah, you know, came back and how the Shah left, and why these students revolted, and then you talk about Iran-Contra, and then the October surprise, and then we had Netanyahu saying whatever the hell he's going to say and then backtracking. And he's allowed to do this. And we're paying for this. You know, and then you have congressmen, you have senators that work more for the state of Israel than they do for their own constituents.
Undeniable.
And, you know, I mean, what? Joe Manchin talks more about Israel probably than he does about his own, you know, the people who put him in office.
And the fact of the matter is, because it is so, and I don't mean this as an insult, okay? I use this term strictly, as I've said in the past, anthropologically. Because the religious right in this country has so thoroughly fetishized Israel, we cannot have a legitimate discussion about it. And what I mean by that is, you know, all that stuff that I was talking to John about. We don't have these conversations about Vietnam.
Not anymore.
Pick any other country. We don't have this conversation about, oh God, Sweden. We don't have this conversation about Kyrgyzstan.
Well, yeah, but Kyrgyzstan has their problems.
I know that. But I mean, the precise nature of the conversation we have about Israel, we don't have any other conversations about any other countries in which we freight our relationship with that country with a bunch of religious hogwash.
Because that's all that it has. If you look at the actual colonialist situation, you know, just like when people want to tell me why, you know, I'm 100% native, because, you know, there's a thing. It's easier to find a black radical or a Native American who is supportive of Israel than is supportive of their own liberation here. And I'm not even talking about going to the levels of actual, you know, leading revolts and what have you. I'm just talking about even making the argument that you have a legitimate right under United Nations statutes after World War II. All anyone has to do is go look at the United Nations resolutions after the war. You know, marginalized peoples, colonialized peoples have a right to argue for statehood. They have a right to do that by international law.
And the largest state making that argument right now is, proto-state or state wishing to be, the Kurds.
Yeah. Well, they've been arguing for that for, you know, quite a while, and they were told, and I don't remember where I read this, but it was an American news service, a mainstream news agency, corporate-owned, that General Colin Powell, when he was in service, pretty much told the Kurds, you will never get a state, so just take it off the table because it's a waste of our time. I think I remember telling you one time. I know I've definitely talked about it on my show. Bloomberg News. Bloomberg News had reported that the Kurds had captured Saddam Hussein and had held him for 3 days as a bargaining chip to try to get some sort of regional autonomy for Kurdistan. And they were told flat out that that's not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen. And remember what Saddam did to the Kurds.
And the thing is, how best to express this? When we talk about such things as states being defined by ethnicity,
yeah, which is always tricky.
It is because first of all, you need to have some sort of actual living proof of the ethnicity. For instance, there's the genomic testing that was done between Palestinians and Israelis, and they're the same people. I mean, if you're talking about people from that area for the last couple of thousand years, they're the same people, genetically speaking. Now it gets a little bit different when you talk about the European influence, because there's a lot of European genetics in there, and I even feel icky getting into this, because the next thing you know, some asshole with a black uniform is talking about the, you know, ethnic purity and master races and shit.
Yeah, but Israel is doing exactly that, though.
But the larger question, though, is that we came up with an idea in the middle of the last millennium via the Peace of Westphalia and the rise of the nation state, where we said that nation states were better when they were comprised of interests as opposed to ethnicities. Because ethnicity and interest are not always the same thing. And there, you know, whether it's the Scottish voting for independence from the United Kingdom, or, you know, breaking out of the UK, or the Kurds, or Israel, or all of those are rejections are they not angry? All of those are rejections of the idea of the nation state as a community of interests as opposed to a community of ethnicities.
Yeah, but again, it goes into, you know, how a particular culture, how a particular people defines themselves as a state. You know, nobody really thinks about Armenia anymore. I mean, they consider themselves to be a state.
And they got steamrolled, and if you mention that, if you mention that to somebody from Turkey, they get very upset.
Yeah,
you know, the Armenian genocide. No, we didn't. Yeah, you did.
I mean, ask somebody from Ulster or someone else who considered themselves to be a Catholic from Northern Ireland. Ulstermen consider themselves to be Ulstermen, right? And then that can blend into...
And they define and they define themselves by their Protestantism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at the same time, how many Unionists? There's plenty of Unionists that are Catholic, which confuses things. You know, like you mentioned with Westphalia. I mean, the whole idea in that sense was, because you and I have talked about this before, Europe is full of mixed ethnicities. There is no goddamn, unless you're dealing, you know, particularly with, say, the Basque or the Serbs, and then maybe the Croatians. Outside of that, you know, or the Celts, there's very few groups that can really be pointed to in Europe and say, yeah, but this group is indigenous. And the Basque have the oldest DNA on
them. I was reading something. Agnes pointed it out to me, and I'm going to have to get her to send it to me again. There's been genetic work done about, you know, who winds up being European. And what, about 7,000, maybe 7,000 BCE, everything changes because, and oddly enough, it bears itself out in testing for lactose tolerance or intolerance.
Yeah, yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
And apparently lactose tolerance in Europe, which was, oddly enough, one of the linchpins of, well, you know, that's why. It's a relative Elsie come lately. European people have not been lactose tolerant for that long, relatively speaking.
Well, for example, I mean, this was pointed out pretty well in Guns, Germs, and Steel. I can't remember the author's name now, the scientist that did this. But what, you know, Europeans like to think, well, you know, the conquistadores, they had so much, you know, skill and military skill. Well, in terms of horse riding, obviously, they grew up riding horses. But they also lived in homes where humans lived next to livestock. They slept with their animals in the house.
Yeah, but one of the things they found is that disease theory may not carry as much water as people had thought it did.
Well, yeah, well, it's an issue of carrying water as a factor, as opposed to saying, well, this is exactly, you know, this is what did it. This is the whole thing. This is what did it.
Well, that's Jared Diamond with his Guns, Germs, and Steel theory.
Yeah.
But it
doesn't answer everything. But it's a damn good explanation on how things have worked out. If you have resources, you can do well. If you have clean water, you'll build there. That's why, you know, most civilizations are found along water. Like they tell you when you join the Boy Scouts, you want to find people, you get lost, find the river, you'll find somebody. You know, because you need these things to live. You need, you know, land in which you can grow vegetation or to graze and what have you. You need these certain basics. And if you don't have these things, your society, just like anything else, is going to, you know, grow up or be shaped by what is there, which is why cuisines and attitudes in some places are this way, and you know, and dress and attitudes and cultural mores are another way someplace else, not because of genetics. This is what Jared was trying to do.
You remind me of that old gag about how you can always survive as long as you've got a calendar and a mattress with you, because you can eat the dates from the calendar and drink the water from the springs.
Well, I mean, I'm not aware of that particular one.
It's an old joke. Get it? Dates, calendar, water from the bed.
I mean, I get it, but I'm just not aware of it. But, you know, in all seriousness, you know, that's why, you know, places turn out the way they turn out. Let's look at the Arab world. Why does the Arab world look the way it does in the countries where it is? Why does Egypt look the way it does? It's been metropolitan for how many thousands of years to one degree or another, and then you have Saudi, which, you know, is virtually nothing. They just started building many of these malls, and they've been making money from the petroleum industry for how long? They have not changed very much. You know, and South America, well, if it hadn't been for Europeans, it would have developed in its own way.
Well, it had, it had developed. It had developed and collapsed and collapsed.
It took that turn that it did. I mean, when you go through South America, most of the Caribbean, it's Spanish. All of the architecture, the names of the roads, the language that is used, even though Spain is only spoken by how many people in Europe? It's not a major world power in terms of a language in Europe. That's German, you know, and English, you know, worldwide. But in South America, outside of Brazil, you know, Spanish, you know, because of what happened, you know, not because of genetics, not because Europeans are superior genetically,
sure.
Not because, you know, Africans are, genetically inferior and what have you. And even when, you know, this sounds unrelated, but these are the arguments that Israel is making. They were just caught a couple of years ago sterilizing Egyptian women against their will. What was done to the state of Israel? We're talking about a country of Jews who have used the argument, and I'm not particularly against this per se, I just don't like the way that they went about it. That, hey, you know, we've been chopped up in Europe for how many goddamn generations? And for anybody that's going to say anything about this, I'm part Ashkenazi. And it's not that I have a right to say this, but, you know, that you know, who can say what, you know, or you can't criticize the Jewish community. Well, that's funny. The Jewish community criticizes the black community every goddamn day. You know, and the thing about it is, we're doing more for you. I mean, how many people realize that Ralph?
But see, in the final analysis, this is where I start losing my mind, angry, because the human race is cursed as long as we continue to see ourselves as this or that tribal group. That's not to say tribalism is bad. Tribal groups come up. I mean, I'm still convinced that if the human race survives, it will survive as a result of indigenous peoples on this planet, and not as a result of the corporate Holocene culture, if you will.
Well, yeah,
the fact of the matter is that there's no gene. There is no gene for being French. Any more than there's a gene for being American or Costa Rican or Bolivian or Australian or Indonesian. There are variances in the genotype, but they are not sufficient to change one's human status.
Well, yeah and no. I mean, medically, I'm more likely to have certain medical problems than
sure.
You
yeah, absolutely. And I'm heir to some that you're not.
Yeah.
But again, those are evolutionary and not clear, and in many instances not clearly, obviously, patently genetic. You know, we're human beings, and you know, a Fijian human can breed with a Danish human, and an Israeli human can breed with an Argentinian human. And we get humans, and maybe that's the real answer, is to finally mix, because the curse here is that we came up with our superstitions before we developed our science. Science will tell us that this is all a lie, but our ancient bigotries and our ancient religions and our ancient prejudices will tell us, nah, you know, kill them.
Yeah, but it still comes back to resources. The main reason, and I try to get people to understand this, because I just finished talking about ethnic nationalism on my last show. You know, I try to get people to look at it this way, especially when we're dealing with Israel, because it is a white European colonialist state that is being backed by other European colonialist states. That is never discussed. Well, one of the things that I'm trying to say is, you know, Jews in Europe as a group, be they Sephardi, you know, mostly out of Spain, or Ashkenazim, or as we know as, you know, pretty much, you know, the white Jew out of Europe. And I'm not even making a Khazar argument here. I'm making a cultural argument, right? You know, these people identified themselves as Jews. They were understood to be Jews by the larger society, and they were forced to live in the Pale. So, you know, I will deal with that alone. I'm not asking a genetic thing, but the bottom line about all of this is they had nothing, and they had very little social power in Europe. So, you know, it's understandable when you have a minority that is being treated the way they were treated, you know, because I'm really not including myself in this, but how Jews were treated in Europe. Because they were not treated the same way in the Muslim world, and that also needs to be discussed. Not to say that it wasn't prejudice. I mean, there certainly goddamn was. But, you know, I mean,
Iran... Well, the so-called Arab world, and I'm saying Arab, not Muslim.
Yeah, Arab, yeah, it does a difference.
Is a big difference because... There's a trend toward, you know, what do you do? And see, this is where my agnosticism kicks in and my anti-religionism kicks in. Insofar as, you know, defining nation states by religion is toxic. Europe learned that lesson.
Not really.
Let's say that there is an ongoing positive learning curve. You know, France used to be deeply religious. Now it's not. The same thing with Germany. You know, Sweden.
But Bob, really, even
England.
But I just want to throw this in. World War II canceled a lot of religion.
Yeah.
You know, I've known people who were in Europe, some Jews, some not. Who were, you know, children, you know, teenagers doing World War II, and they were like, look, you know, nobody believed in God after what happened. We just didn't. And then the winter of 47 came in, and, you know, nobody had anything. There was still austerity in most of Europe. So, you know, again, conditions. And I'm saying that if Jews were not being treated the way that they were being treated in Europe, they wouldn't have been so extremist. And I mean that when I'm talking about Zionism. Now, Zionism in and of itself is not a bad thing. But, you know, the decisions that they have made over the decades, you know, over the generations, you know, I mean, Israel is sterilizing Ethiopian women. We have Netanyahu on record saying that they want all of the Africans out of Israel. It would be better for Africans to be back in Africa. This is what he said. This is somebody from Philly now. You see, this is what I'm talking about. More gold in my ear was from Cincinnati.
Wow.
This is what I'm trying to, you know, this is where the discussion should be. Who are these people who had nothing a few generations ago to now make decisions on what states, you know, around them have a right to exist or not, and what ethnic groups should have a right to exist or not? If Israel had never made the argument that this is a Jewish state, we wouldn't be having this discussion. But they do make that argument. And Netanyahu would make that argument when he figures that it will scare enough people to back them by keep bringing up the Holocaust, by keep bringing up the European Holocaust. Now, it gets to a point when it's obvious that you're using that for political purposes, not because you're trying to point out. I mean, look, let's be honest. The Christian world sat and watched Europe burn Jews and did nothing. The Roosevelt government did nothing. The Churchill government did nothing.
When we talk about Europe, there's a thousand years of persecution.
Of persecution, right? Which was started by the Catholic Church, of which nobody wants to discuss. Even people who don't like Catholics, because of the religious sectarianism, do not want to discuss that because it's Christianity. And that means Christianity will have to take responsibility for the Crusades and all the people that were wiped out in Germany on the way up to the Crusades when Urban said, go get them. They murdered people on sight, and not just Jews. They took out as many Rom people, you know, as many gypsies as they possibly could. They took out everybody because these were poor Germans, poor Italians, poor Frenchmen who were landless and had nothing. And the idea was, if you make it to the Holy Land, if you can survive the trip, and if you can survive the battle, you can claim a piece of land for yourself. And when I'm saying that,
well, that sounds a lot like the colonization of the Western Hemisphere.
Of the Western Hemisphere, right, in parts of North Africa when we talk about Arabs. You know, I mean, you know, or in terms of even South America when we look at how Mexico spread. These were empires, too. They had to hurt somebody. They had to find a way to rationalize taking somebody's land. That's why these religions always say in the national stories of every country, it's like, well, you know, God gave us this land, or we had this right to fight for this land. And such and such. But all countries, all borders are the results of past conflicts, be it over food or other resources, sometimes even women. you know, you have a group where there's not that many women, they're not reproducing. It's not a sexual
thing.
That's
one of the, that's
part of it.
That's part and parcel of the origin myth of the Romans, the rape of the Sabine women.
Yeah, and of the Exodus story. You know, it was okay to take the virgins of the groups that they ran into when they were supposedly leaving, because there's many rabbis now that are saying that they don't believe that Jews ever left. You know, I mean, Jews traveled. Many Jews, because of the famine in Canaan.
Well, look, the rise of even after the diaspora that came after the Jewish War, as it was put down by Titus. You know, that's 72 of the Common Era.
Yeah.
There's another uprising 150, 200 years later. Everybody didn't leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always been Jews in the area, and I've made that argument. But I've had more, you know, Israeli Jews argue with me that that wasn't true. And I'm like, wait a minute. Part of your literature says you were always there. I'm actually supporting that, because I know for a fact the Jews had never left. And they have been living alongside their Palestinian neighbors pretty well.
Well, Flavio was talking about Mark Twain earlier.
Yeah,
and I think, didn't Mark Twain, in his visit to the Holy Land, didn't he remark upon the peoples that he met? I mean, and I've read somewhere, you know, accounts of poor ultra Orthodox Jews living in the Holy Land, their wives working like slaves, so that the men would not have to work and to devote their lives to studying Torah. I know where that came from. That comes from Barbara Tuchman, Bible and Sword.
Oh, Barbara Tuchman wrote that, and I'm not aware of it. No, I'm not aware of that one. I mean, I know he traveled. His trip around the equator, I know I've read at least at length once.
I think any remarks that Twain makes are in not following the equator, not A Tramp Abroad. Oh, The Innocents Abroad.
Yeah,
because that was specifically a trip to the Holy Land.
Yeah, see, I don't remember the details. I might have seen it, but I don't remember it. But, you know, I have at least one photograph, anyway, of two, I don't want to say elders, but, you know, they're two older men. One's obviously Jewish. The other one is obviously, you know, Palestinian. And this was in the 1920s. They're sharing, you know, they're having cigarettes and they're talking. And apparently, you know, this was life there. You know,
consider Moorish Spain. It was a flourishing of learning, because you had a cosmopolitan peaceful intermingling of cultures. And it's only the God-fearing, upstanding Christians who ruined that. And we're talking about, you know, of course, Isabella and Ferdinand.
Yeah, but the underlying thing about that was they made it a racial argument, right? Because these North Africans were not European, right? Many of the Christians there were not European. Because, as you said, it was a learning center, Salamanca, right? The University of Salamanca, which I've heard.
During the Caliphate in Baghdad, there were noted rabbis and scholars who were called to that court.
Yeah.
Most people take it as red angry that there is that it's straight out of 1984. One country's always been at war with the other country, blah, 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 blah. And so we assume that Muslims and Jews have always not gotten along. It ain't true.
It's not true, yeah. It's not true. I mean, when Alexander came through, they fought together to try to defend themselves against him.
When Caesar was trying to prop up Cleopatra, he had tremendous support from the Jewish community in Alexandria. And in point of fact, Caesar himself was raised not on the Palatine Hill, but down in what was called the Sabura. And one of the things we know is that he came into contact with a wide variety, because, you know, Rome was a crossroads, and there was a huge immigrant population, and he came in contact with them.
Well, he had ancient Rome had a sizable Jewish population. I mean, that was one of the problems, right? There were certain things that they weren't willing to do because they held on to their culture, which is the same thing that really rubbed a lot of people the wrong way in Europe. They, you know, that there's been arguments made that Jews could have been accepted if they were willing to work on Saturday, you know, or if they didn't do, if they were really into marry, and it was their clannishness that kept them together. Well, I mean, that was an excuse. But the reason that their culture is still together.
But you didn't, there aren't any accounts that I'm aware of in the ancient world of pogroms or persecutions until you come into the end of the Roman Imperial Age.
Well, yeah, everything was falling apart.
Not just that. Yeah, I mean, you get the Great Fire of Rome under Nero, and I forget who it is that mentions it, but that the fire was the fault of an obscure sect who followed someone, and it's spelled in the writings Crestus, Crestus.
Yeah. So Claudius didn't jot this down. You're saying somebody else did.
Yeah, I forget who it is, but it's that's one of the few mentions of the early Christian cult that exists, and it's after that you get the persecution of the early Christian church. Which up until, and man, we're going to run out of time in a hurry, until Paul wanders along is an offshoot cult within Judaism.
But being that you mentioned the Roman Empire, this is a good way to look at the relationship between the United States and its client state, Israel. How many barbarians who, when they couldn't be paid any longer, turned on their benefactor?
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, and we're seeing the exact same thing here. You know, the equestrian class, you know, was running the empire dry, and they didn't care if people were dying in their slums, and they didn't care about the disease that was going on. You know, they didn't care about the graft and what have you, as long as they were getting paid. And if that meant them holding on to money as opposed to fixing the roads and the bridges and everything else that they needed to keep the system running, to keep commerce going. I mean, even the sale of garum. When they stopped backing that, people lost money and things got bad. And what I'm trying to say is the barbarians wouldn't have been able to get as far as they did, perhaps, if there weren't Romans that were willing to help them, because these people were pissed about their condition.
Right, because there was always a denarius to be made, right, or a talent.
Or a talent.
Yeah, and that's another one of those radio moments for this program. I dare and defy anyone to find me a progressive or right wing, either one, find me a radio show in which anyone has mentioned garum today, or last week, or this week, or in the last month.
It was just on my mind.
No. I cherish that. Angry, I got to get out of here, brother.
All right, peace, my man. Please support the show. Peace.
Thank you. And note coming in from Steve in China, philosophy for beginners. Good luck making a rational argument out of the lunacy that results from identifying one's ethnic or economic or cultural interests with the moral interests of numerous scattered tribes and their all-powerful gods. Of the three recognized branches of philosophy, moral philosophy is the prime example of systems without solution. The standard handbook for all of that is Plato's Republic, which is also something like a primer on genetic selection in pursuit of the good life. The critical problem is not morality. It is to accept one's ultimate annihilation and so to die well. Regards, Steve in China. And thank you, thank you one and all for your time spent in sharing the program this evening. And thank you to Gary Laborman for getting us started. This program has been brought to you by Laborman. He did have a Moran Monday on me. Thank you again, Gary. And that was followed by a challenge from Ron, who offered to match the first $75 that came in, which was followed by $75 coming in from Kelly. Thank you, Kelly, and thank you, Ron. So that means that we've got a little bit of breathing room, and we can go into Titanic Tuesday without being in quite such a sweat. So that's it for us tonight. Thank you to everybody who makes all of this go. Thank you to everyone who shares their time listening to the program. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan and Carol Baker. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks, of course, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.